Yes. From Middlesex University.
Oh, I know, I feel terrible because that woman's like up on the hill. She's now on the floor. That's funny.
My name is Carly Guest and this is Rachel Shoga, and we're going to be talking about the closure of college. I just want to make we've got lots of images for you, and I just want to say that we have permission to share the images from the museum, but not to kind of circulate them. So if you don't mind, I'm sorry not to be restrictive, but if you don't mind not taking photos, that'd be great. One day they'll be out there, but there are very early stages of their collection. So HMP Holloway, the largest women's prison in Europe, closed in the summer of this year, 2016. Whatever happened to the building and the lands now it is closed, it's important to think about what structures, practices and people are made visible in the stories that are told about Holloway and which remain hidden, as well as how emotion circulates in these accounts. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, the names of many of Holloway's most notorious inmates were at the forefront of media accounts following the announcement of Holloway's closure. People like Myra Hindley, Rose West, and Ruth Ellis were often named alongside suffragettes, Sylvia and Emmeline Pankhurst. Adding to this sense that Holloway's present is subsumed by its past, it is frequently referred to as a Victorian prison in these reports. This is despite the prison actually being rebuilt in the 1980s. Maureen Mansfield, curator of the Holloway Prison Stories website, notes this media fixation on Holloway's past. She writes, quote, "What strikes me as odd, even misleading, is to spend so much time talking about the history of the place without drawing parallels to the modern prison and the problems facing it and facing society," end quote. But I think this misdirection is entirely the point of the reporting, and it's something that's deliberately invoked in Michael Gove's statement announcing the closure in 2015, and reinforced in the media discussion. The effect of this narrative, where Holloway's past is so current, is to reinforce the contrast between the old and the new, and the antiquated and the modern. In the reasons given for Holloway's closure, this contrast drawn out in the reasons given for Holloway's closure. In the statements announcing the closure, Gove talks of radical reform, of a new beginning, a move to more humane surroundings and to a high-quality prison estate, away from the inadequate and antiquated Holloway. He talks of 21st solutions to the problem of criminality, rendering Holloway its building and approach to the past. In Gove's statement, and supported by the fixation on Holloway's past in the media reporting, the problem of criminality, and I don't think the use of a word with such individualistic, deterministic, and ironically Victorian connotations is accidental here, is in the Victorian prison and the women who reside there, rather than in the very contemporary political landscape of a housing crisis, of cuts to support services, and the increased severity of sentencing. In making Holloway's Victorian past so present, the discussion of its closure is one that is framed by a discourse of progress and is invested in the remaking and reimagining of the modern carceral space as something other than an inner-city prison. When this image of the antiquated Victorian building is invoked, any inadequacies that the buildings the women have been moved to remain invisible. Holloway's historic building is highly visible, if not materially present in the stories generated about its closure. It is summoned as a justification for the modernisation of the prison estate. We don't need to talk about the problems with the prison system or with the criminalisation of women for largely non-violent offences if we can invoke the ghost of Holloway as the past container of all its ills.
So, thinking about the prison's closure and the displacement of women in terms of geographies of exclusion, this is consistent with contemporary practices of punishment. So, moving punitive institutions to the periphery, you can see Downview and the down there, pretty far from Holloway, in the city space. to the periphery where they're increasingly invisible. So Michelle Brown's work on penal spectatorship and cultures of punishment is revealing in the context of the government's plans for what it's calling a prisons revolution, an expansive, modernising institutional revolution. Both the physical prisoners and the emotional reactions their presence might provoke are considered undesirable in contemporary urban space. While the value of the prison might formerly have been gauged by its disciplinary or deterrent function, this is no longer the case in a society that's entirely normalised the culture of punishment. Under today's logics of punishment, capitalism has become more important than disciplinary logic. The land itself is more valuable than the symbolic currency of the prison, and the culture of punishment is so powerful, so pervasive, and self-evident that the physical presence of prison in urban spaces is no longer necessary. In fact, the purpose of the prison is not to make visible the criminal and hold her up as a focus of derision, but to render her invisible, to subsume her into the system. She needs to vacate central London so that the space can be used to generate great sums of capital to the state. Or maybe the very presence of the woman is best understood as threatening the distance created between the prisoners and the wider community in Holloway, though the walls and the locked doors formalise their status as other, as criminals. An emotional distancing that's often inherently classed and racialised usually sustains the physical distancing between prisoners and citizens. The realities of prison are comfortably distant from white and class citizens. But the very presence and architecture of a prison in a residential space risks unsettling wider society's readiness to inflict pain on others, to feel entitled to take things away from them. Our access to the world of imprisonment is often through cultural and political practices and discourses that are far removed from actual institutions and everyday life in those institutions. Citizens construct logics of punishment that are summoned from a distance, from cultural fragments that are formed without direct connection to or knowledge of what prison spaces mean to and do to women. So by practicing punishment in the periphery, the visceral and uncomfortable realities of punishment are taken further away, and the culture of punishment that exists in what Brown calls a shadow world of moral judgment and penal logic outside the prison walls can flourish. Secreting away the prisoners in peripheral spaces increases the already enormous divide between the physical realities of the prison and the cultural imagination of punishment and the purposes it serves.
But of course, narratives of punishment are always multiple and movable, and competing character narratives of Holloway's story are emerging in various forms. And some of these are ones that are concerned with making the practices of punishment and women's experiences visible. One interesting example of these is the always political creation of museum collections that is happening at the moment. Some reinforce the media account of the history of Holloway and pushing practices of punishment to the periphery, and others try to resist this. So for example, many of the objects collected by the Museum of London tell a story of Holloway that we might expect. So they have the famous griffins that flag the front doors of the Victorian building, the chair in which the suffragettes were reportedly force-fed, and the bell that was used to summon prisoners to labour and chapel. This history of Holloway feeds into a narrative of the spectacular, the extraordinary, and the salacious. And whilst these are stories that it's of course important to know about, as Rhys Stafford Jones, James Robinson, and Jennifer Turner write, presence ought not to be reduced to the spectacular, for the spectacular serves to emphasise extraordinary acts, not banal appearances. What Islington Museum are doing, in contrast, in the creation of its collection, is documenting this everyday and banal through photographs and objects from Holloway's much more recent past. In doing so, they nuance the story of an inadequate narrative of Holloway without either reducing it to its history or romanticising its presence. The photographs we're going to share raise questions not only about whether Holloway's closure is a move from the antiquated to the modern, but one that questions how spaces that are designed to restrict movement and to monitor and manage behaviour are ever adequate to address the needs of many incarcerated women. So we can see here, so we have a huge number of photos of the space post-closure that give us a sense of the structure and size of the building as well as its detail. We can see here the harsh lighting in the photos on the left, the very narrow beds and the lack of privacy in the cell. So this is a picture of the toilet door in a cell that has huge gaps at the bottom and the top of the door. But these images can only tell us a partial story about how the women lived their lives through these spaces and how the various mechanisms of the criminal justice system were enacted through these corridors. We're just going to talk about some of the kind of themes that have come up through looking through these photographs, with bearing in mind that it's always telling us a partial story. So there are, unsurprisingly, multiple mechanisms of surveillance throughout the prison and embedded in its design. But what these photographs here show is the numerous ways in which women have modified these modes of surveillance as a means of challenging or resisting it, or perhaps simply drawing attention to it. Okay. So you can see a piece of string and covering up the mirrors and the peephole in the toilet using toothpaste. There are some comments made on the emergency alarms that use humour to highlight the absences in the space. So the room service comment marks out the disjuncture between the possibilities of inside and outside spaces, but also may suggest in some way a subversion of the power dynamics between guards and women, between the guards and the women, as it becomes a mechanism for summoning the guards. There's a playful reimagining of this emergency alarm as a mode of stress relief, but this is something that draws attention to the emotional dynamics of prison life and the disjunction between these needs and the possibility of the prison space meeting these needs.
So the inadequacies of the institutional space are exposed to the women's modifications of the fixtures and the fittings. So the harshness of the cell lights, which are controlled outside by the guards centrally rather than the women from inside their cells, those have been modified by using paper card to change the lighting within the cell, and the harshness of that light. And drafts coming in through the ventilators are altered using pieces of material, paint, and in this image here, sanitary towels. So cold metal toilet seats are made more comfortable with pieces of tissue, card, and sanitary towels again. So living day to day in these spaces requires the women to make use of materials available to them to make it more manageable and more comfortable. So the use of sanitary towels in particular speaks to the limited kinds of materials that are available. So items that are usually hidden in the bathroom cabinet in the home are put on public display or display within the cell. So in this space, the modifications are also personalised the space. So toothpaste is used a lot as an adhesive to stick things to the cell walls. And in these images we can see that one woman has collected six of these really strikingly tiny mirrors, they're only like this small, and put them together to make them into a more workable, like normal sized mirror. And these photos also show the kinds of decorations that have been done around the mirrors. So this decorative focus maybe reminds us that women's control over the way they look, behave and treat themselves in these kind of very regulated, rule-based institutions they become a focus within these spaces. We might think about the gendered emotional effects of separation from one's own image, particularly in a society that's so obsessed with one's image, and how women's feelings are so often intimately connected to how they look. So when you can only see your face in a tiny, poor quality mirror, what can that do to your sense of self, and how do you hold on to your image of yourself? So all these practices have exposed the inadequacies of space and the various ways that women interact with it to make it more comfortable, livable, and personal.
The cells also became places through which women formed, solidified, managed, and commemorated relationships. So there were numerous examples of messages commemorating the emotional ties formed in the prison. So we can see the illustration of three cellmates here. Other messages on the toilet doors offered ways of managing relationships and living with people in small spaces. And there was also a great number of these kind of messages that were offering advice and encouragement to other women and future women who in the future will be coming into the space. The traces of the women, their lives, relationships, emotions and experiences of the space can be found in all these images. One really interesting thing that kept coming up throughout these images is how the women's impact on the space was being erased. So as the curator of Islington was moving around the space, looking at the graffiti, there was somebody following her painting over the graffiti, not very effectively. But it was there were attempts already being made to sanitize the space, presumably from potential developers.
So just in terms of reflecting on kind of the emotional life that's held within the prison, we're just thinking about how to hold on to your own emotional life in close proximity to others and how that might be kind of mapped onto the space. So we want to kind of explore how women elicit emotional responses from others that shape the quality of their emotional experiences in these spaces, and to explore how the closure of Holloway has disrupted and transformed this. So just two of the questions that we want to pose going further with this is, how might women protect the boundaries of themselves in this emotionally loaded space? And how do women maintain their sense of visibility and existence in systems so committed to their erasure? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carly. Thanks, Rachel. Some really fascinating both questions. So I'm going to be awash with questions now.
About the sort of media narrative surrounding Holloway's closure. I thought that was really interesting, and it's something which I wondered if you detected the same pattern in sort of the narrative surrounding some other London prisons, in particular Pentonville in recent times, doing a little bit of work there and speaking with, you know, people who don't work in sector about Pentonville, mentioning that I've been there. I've got the same comment back again and again, oh, isn't that that really terrible Victorian prison? And like, and I've had basically exactly what you were saying in the first half of the presentation has been my response, and I just wonder, like, I don't know if you picked up on the same pattern generally outside of just the women's state.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of specifically about the media, we haven't really looked outside of the Holloway space, but I think it's a really interesting point. One of the things that we've been thinking about is how these kind of, how the discussion of the prison system and what kind of happens inside of the prison is such a caricature, and in a way it's a kind of way of managing not having to engage with what is happening right here, like, and especially when we think about inner city prisons that you kind of go and past every single day, or people are living right around. So I think part of that kind of characterization of Pentonville or Holloway or whatever it might be in these kind of quite general ways, I think it's a way of managing maybe that anxiety of what is actually happening and what are these processes of punishment. But I think one of the fine things that I think we've both been talking about and quite challenging is how do you kind of counter that narrative without saying prisons are great. It's a real challenge. So I think in the media, I guess especially, there's this really sort of dichotomous reporting where are you positioning yourself? Are you kind of saying, you know, Holloway's a great institution that needs to stay, but we need to kind of think about what was actually happening in Holloway and what were the, and I suppose this is why we kind of want to, what our plans are, is to talk to women who have experience in Holloway and you know, what was the closure, the announcement of closure and the process like for them. So, I think, and one of the things I found really interesting about, sorry, was the kind of lack of media discussion. was a sort of unspokenness about Holloway's closure. A lot of people that we'd spoken to in the local community didn't really know that it was closing. So I think that's another aspect of media reporting.
Yeah. I just think all of this kind of, this narrative of progress and more clean and less dangerous. It's just a way of naturalising the prison state and kind of moving to more efficient, kind of more humane forms of punishment, which doesn't actually challenge the fact that, you know, the vast majority of women shouldn't be in prison in the first place. You know, 80% of prison women are in prison for non-violent crimes. So
really short sentence.
Really short sentence. So it's like, you know, moving towards, although we want to kind of like challenge this naturalisation, how to engage with women's experiences in the paradigm.
Just with what you said at the end about how we hear and we can't, the voices are stopping being erased, I just wondered if you'd seen the piece that was in Kurzweil, some of the pieces this year. It's fantastic. I went on the opening and there was one of the girls who was there when it closed, and it was one of her pieces and she explained it to me.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It was like a tribute to it, but pulling out all the kilns, like the griffin thing. And
is that Nikki?
Yeah. And just her going through all the little snapshots that she put in there, like the governor overlooking it all, and drones taking out the drugs rather than dropping them in, and all things like that. And I thought that's quite showing the story that way. It's quite a nice way of recording the sort of the positive without it being, like, say, going to prison's wonderful.
Yeah.
And how do I have some pieces in Nikki's work?
It's really important, and I suppose that's kind of actually a woman's form of authorship, like that's her own expression of her experience there, and I think, she seems like a really kind of treasured person within that institution, actually, that she's really well supported.
And I think that if it's the same piece that was at South Bank for the Possible Exhibition, it's so detailed and complex that it can't, it kind of demonstrates that there isn't a straightforward story to be told, and there are, I think looking at those kind of visual expressions of that experience.
I think it was also from talking to her that you realise how many stories she put in that one thing, but then she does need sort of the narrative from her to go with it, otherwise
which
you're
is
like,
what these,
great.
Yeah, which is what these images need as well. We're kind of right at the beginning without actually talking to women and about this space. So we've tried, and I think, to be quite cautious in kind of saying this is what it means. But
it really leads to, I think, like the complexity of women's experiences of these institutions. Like, you can kind of read in reports about the prison and reports by charities like Women in Prison about how, they are places of friendship as well as places of kind of coercive violence and incarceration, and that often escape from a domestic like abusive relationship happens in prison. So there's this really kind of complex, and the forms of solidarity that can be formed within that with other women in similar positions, and the support workers that are doing excellent work within those. So it's like it shouldn't be there, but there are the good things happening there. So I think we're still kind of struggling.
And being able to think about the prison as a possible sort of site of safety for some of the women, but that's not a comment on, that creates massive problems with, what is outside this prison space of people and people who are
Okay, ladies, I'll leave it there again, scrolling down, I'm the last one at the end.